I want to remember somebody who was a part of this show, Paul Elisha. Mm. And Paul was here when you came, right?
Yeah.
And was doing commentary.
He did commentary, and he also helped Bernie Steinberg with the music library. And they got along really well.
Like, what's that thumping on the other side of the
yeah. Yeah, they shared a wall with the newsroom. Occasionally, we heard screaming. yeah, he was here, and just a sort of our resident intellectual.
Paul passed on several years ago, and but was such a part of this program, did performance place, and was our poet in residence. And he, we found a poem that he did on this program, and it was, I believe it was 2004, I'm pretty sure. And this is such a Paul topic, but it was about poetry and peace and resistance. And the name of the poem is called Where War is Waged. And in honor of Paul and the great work and how much he gave to this show, because we just adored this man so much. And he was such a special part of the show. So as we say goodbye to Mike and Judith and Rich and Libby, we're going to hold Susan for a little while. But I just want to play this for you. This is Paul Elisha reading his poem called Where War is Waged.
In snows of Kilimanjaro, we've read of a spent expatriate's legacy to his nephew. Legend embedded in a note about a leopard found by climbers, its body perfectly preserved in ice far above Mount Kibo's tree line. No one could divine a reason or account for what in any season might entice it there where a leopard shouldn't have been. Then within my own lifetime, I perceived an answer on a Micronesian dot, sprawled not a yard from the water's edge, a pledge to take this place or die trying, defying certain logic arrayed against us. Despite a maelstrom shredding the air on every side, we were chided to move ahead, displace fear with lobbed grenade and bayonet thrust, trusting to blind luck or belief in an absent God, embargoed from this charnel of our creation. Awaiting the instant that delusion said was safe from danger, I heard a deranged laugh waft high above the flood of false courage. Can someone please tell me what in goddamn hell we're doing here? I think I knew the answer then, but didn't know how to tell it, an accompaniment of machine gun chatter quelling my words. Now I also understand why others simply couldn't have heard it, fraught with fear of peril's omnipresence, their ears loath to learn truth that tyranny would have taught them. Wherever war is waged, demurral nags at innards, impels someone to raise the axiomatic question, and always the same answer applies. We're doing what events have said we must. Still, the painful lesson goes misprized. Some battles become necessary. Fated aftermaths of greed, neglect, intemperance deferred and left to fester. Yesterday's mistakes erased at hideous cost, but none is unavoidable. Yet in the not-too-distant future, in another godforsaken space, some nameless dog-faced rifleman will be heard chanting his plaintive refrain above the killing's cacophony. Please, can someone tell me what in hell we're doing here? And without hearing a reply, he'll know the answer.
No, I'm fine.
Paul Elisha and the poem Where War Is Waged, and I think we timestamped that at 2004. Mm. So I'm going to tell a story.
Do you have a Paul Elisha story?
Well, no, I mean, Paul was so great. I actually do have a Paul Elisha story, but I think we all have Paul Elisha stories.
Some we can tell, some not so much.
Keyword, $5. Okay, so...
I know what story you're talking
about. Oh, my God. But... no, what I was going to say is that, you know, we've been so fortunate and Paul has just these incredible moments and did such, I think he made the show.
He gave it some heft.
He really did.
Yeah.
He really did. And he brought these incredible poets on with him.
Right. Stu Bartow.
Yes. I mean, Robert Pinsky. And it was Grace Paley. I mean, it was really incredible. And did
somehow
a,
he
did
put
a
up with us.
Job. He did. He did.
He's a World War II veteran, a poet, a musician. He was sort of a Renaissance man. Older. He was like 30 years older than we were at the time. Mm. And yeah, he put up with us.
And
we were his fetuses.
What a lovely way to put that.
Joe, I've been bottled up for a long time.
No, I know. I know. It's so nice to have you unbottled, as it were. I do want to get into some of the things that we've done over the years. And one of the stories that you did was called The Spirituals Project. And how much of this do you remember?
I listened to it recently because you told me that we were going to play it. And I remember David Alan Miller, who is the maestro of the Albany Symphony Orchestra, telling me that he had this idea to sort of bring people who had feet in both the world of spirituals and the world of opera together for a special program by the Albany Symphony. And I went and I got them while they were rehearsing. And it was amazing. And re-listening to it, I realized that now, with the sensibilities that are a little bit different than they were in 2004 or whenever I did this, I would have put the black voices more forward in the piece. That said, you know, I think the piece came out pretty well. I think that some of the music that we heard was just... I mean, it makes you cry.
And your mixing and your storytelling in it is really stunning.
Thank you.
We're going to hear this. This is the Spirituals Project going back to 2004.
There is a competition taking place at the Canfield Casino this afternoon. And uncharacteristically, the casino is losing. The soaring 19th century ballroom with its patina of old Saratoga money is being humbled by the plaintive melody of spirituals. The musicians of the Albany Symphony Orchestra are here rehearsing for their concert, a series of spirituals reinterpreted by composers from different cultures and different musical backgrounds. It is called the Spirituals Project, and it is ASO music director David Alan Miller's idea.
Well, it really came to me because I did a concert with the Pittsburgh Symphony on which I wanted to play some spirituals, and I was quite struck at how few really compelling orchestral arrangements of spirituals I could find. It turns out there are some, and there's some very nice ones. Often they tend to be in the direction of kind of popsy sounding, sort of big bandish, or you know, just very muzak-y.
Miller wanted these spirituals to be given a more thoughtful treatment, and his decision is reflected in the composers he's picked to bring the project to life. Among the group are several music professors, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and a Guggenheim fellow.
And it seemed to me that it would be really intriguing to hear how a group of of very skilled, very expert, and very poetical American composers, how they would handle these texts, setting them in their own inimitable, unique, singular style.
Reinterpreting spirituals is nothing new, according to University of California, Davis, Assistant Professor of Music Sandra Graham. After the Civil War, groups like the Fisk Jubilee Singers traveled around the country raising money for their school by entertaining white audiences with remakes of the spirituals.
These were spirituals with a difference, whereas before the Civil War, spirituals were usually sung unaccompanied, and everybody sang them. They were participatory and communal. After the war, these were rearranged in kind of like a hymn-like harmony to make them more palatable and understandable to a white audience.
Sometime I feel like a motherless child. Sometime I feel like a motherless child.
Before the Civil War, spirituals like this one were sung as forms of worship in praise houses or in clearings under the cover of darkness by slaves defying their masters.
Spirituals were also code songs that were used on the Underground Railway. So you might have a song like Steal Away to Jesus, and Steal Away would signal that it would be time tonight to literally steal away to the north. They were used as a kind of socializing music at the end of the day. They were used as work songs, so that they were multifunctional.
David, when the brass first come in, da 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 dee da da, if they could, did you say that already? Die away more.
The ascending.
At the end, when it hangs over into the next measure, da dee da dee.
ASO music director David Allen Miller and composer David Del Tredici are working out the kinks in Del Tredici's fantasy on Nobody Knows the Trouble I Seen. Del Tredici, who won the Pulitzer Prize for one of his classical compositions, says this project was a great opportunity for him to try his hand at a very different kind of musical form and to hear how the other composers did the same.
It's amazing in these seven settings by the seven composers, they are so different. It's like a Rorschach test. The musical is really quite almost neutral, and we all pull out different things from it.
As a white gay man, he says he can understand the weight of prejudice in society, a sympathy which factored into his musical choice.
Well, I certainly hook into the repression part, and that a lot was denied me. The equivalent of sitting in the back of the bus is certainly my experience, and now that gay marriage is such an issue, you really see the naked face of prejudice. And I always relate it to nowadays, the gay marriage issue, to miscegenation, you know. A lot of people have not seen the trouble I've seen.
While white Americans may be able to sympathize, there will always be an incomplete understanding of the black experience, which makes one wonder if it's considered taking liberties to reinterpret what are, at their very essence, songs born out of enslavement by white people. Again, UC Davis professor Sandra Graham.
You asked me is it kosher to remake a spiritual, and in fact it is. It's more than kosher. This is how the music gets perpetuated. So spirituals have always been remade. They've been performed as jazz. They've been performed as gospel. They've been performed as art music. They've been performed as avant-garde art music. So they're always being refashioned, and they're always making new statements.
The vocalist for the Spirituals project is New York City-based baritone Nathan Deshaun Myers, who understands both concert music and spirituals. It's a bridge that he's had to forge professionally as both an opera singer and a gospel singer. Myers says that initially he had some reservations about the Spirituals project, but after listening to the musical translations, he felt the composers were honoring the music.
It's not as if they're just arrangers, because these are all great composers in their own right, and they took a piece of them and poured it out. And that's special to me, to know that they took that kind of time, you know, the same as if they were writing a concerto or they were giving homage to Mozart or Beethoven, you know. They took the time out and poured in their artistry it's very honoring to have people who are outside of my particular race that deem it a valid endeavor to explore my culture.
That view is echoed by Dr. Michael Woods, an associate professor of jazz studies at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, and the composer behind the reinterpretation of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
Anyone from any nationality, any level and type and amount of musical training, if they bring their compositional skills to the table to set these melodies, which were originally sung by black people, and they set them to music, they're honoring the original people who came up with these melody lines, or else we wouldn't be hearing the orchestrations in the first place. So I'm honored by that. I'm not offended by that at all. I'm greatly honored by that.
The Albany Symphony Spirituals project could be considered the next chapter in a continuum of musical borrowing and lending and retranslating between black and white musicians, from the Fisk Jubilee Singers to Elvis Presley to Eminem. Vocalist Nathan Deshaun Myers is aware of that legacy, and for him, there is now less of a schism between the two musical worlds he inhabits.
That especially for an artist such as myself, and there are other artists, especially some of my colleagues and friends who have grown up in church but were introduced through the example of Marian Anderson and Leontine Price, or even there's Denise Graves, even, you know, modern day, these people who all got their start in churches, but we kind of mix the two. It behooves me, you know, not to reject, you know, where I've come from, not to reject all of the knowledge that I've gained studying opera. I want to put them together. Of course, each one has its, you know, separate box, but there are times when they come together, and this is one of those times. This is one of those times.
For WAMC News, I'm Susan Arbetter.
Swing low, sweet chariot, come in to carry me home, swing low, sweet chariot.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on our special 25th anniversary 25th anniversary celebration of the program today. We are thrilled to have Susan Arbetter in the studio. Susan was one of the founders of this show and of the Roundtable all those years ago. 25 years ago.
Wow.
We have not yet said quarter of a century.
But that is what it is.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to be honest with ourselves. We're old. We're old. And this show is pretty old.
Yeah. We
Sarah LaDuke is not old.
Not old.
No.
Not old.
I'm older than I used to be.
Yeah, but
that's how that works.
Can I tell you something though? You're still like a baby. Okay, I look at you.
I
see that collagen, and I'm just like, wow.
That seems like I'm adopted.
That's youth.
I'm adopted. My genetics are unknown.
Okay,
this does feel like some kind of genetic gift from a bio mom.
Yeah.
The way the collagen is holding up.
Because
boy, am I tired, and have I been working hard for a long time?
Yeah, but boy, you look great.
Well, thank you. So do you.
Those bangs are killing me.
Susan is going to, she has a day job.
Yes.
And,
she's very hard working.
Yeah, she has to go.
As
and, what time do you usually, your show is on at night, but what time do you usually?
Oh, I get in around 11.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's sort of a luxury.
Yeah.
Yeah. Compared to what we used to do here.
Right.
Which was insanity.
Yes.
But, yeah, so 11 and, we always do a morning meeting at 9:30, read the papers, go through everything, get to the station at 11, prep the interviews, do the interviews, make my calls, talk to people, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. And then we do the show at 7.
And then you put a show together. And that goes out throughout the state.
It's throughout the state minus New York City and Long Island.
Yeah, screw them.
Because they're it's not really a...
They can't hear this show either unless they're online, so pff.
Yeah. It's not really a big community of listeners down there anyway.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of a small town. So, yeah. But we do have, you know, we have a sister station down there, New York One.
Yes.
Yeah, so they get their own sort of Capital Tonight down there.
So after you left and everything went into a free fall and...
I don't believe that for 1 second.
We, you know, it took us a little while to find our footing again. But then what you just said, about 2000 and...
I started working at WAMC in 2006. I started working on the roundtable early autumn of 2007.
Yes. And then we were sort of saved. And then...
learn a lot as I went along because I was not trained up to be a radio producer.
That's 18 years, right?
You, 18 years. You started as an engineer.
I did.
I remember.
Weekend board op. Yeah.
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 That's right.
And then, so it's been really incredible.
We're you belong some... here. Seriously.
Well,
doing
she's not getting
great.
Out now.
No,
yeah.
I don't know how to do anything else.
No, none of us do, Sarah. I mean, what would we do if we weren't doing this? Well, sell hats at the mall, right?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Oh, it would be.
We have one skill.
Talking.
Yeah.
Yes. People. Talking right. to people. That's right. So I know you have to. I know you have to go. And I, first of all, I just want to say it means so much to me that you joined us.
Joe, please. It means so much to me that you asked. I am thrilled to be here, and this is really the most meaningful moment that I've had. such an empty life that this is such a remark. It is actually a remarkable, wonderful, warm, funny, awesome time. I'm loving this.
It's been great, great fun. I have to say, last night Susan texted me and she said, "Is it okay if I mention this to promote it?" And I said, "Sure, you can have the exclusive." we didn't really do because for two reasons. We didn't know what the state of the world was going to be in which we were going to have a show, and we didn't want to like promise a show and then not do a show.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then also we thought it would just be fun to like surprise, like just, you know, do a surprise and, just come in and do it. And I thought it would be fun to have the theme, which I blew at the top of the hour, but that's,
that's part of the show too.
That was,
happening occasionally,
yeah.
Right?
So
it's tradition.
Yeah, it is tradition.
I'll kick myself
this
all the
just
way home
in
for that.
Joe like, Donahue.
I cared so much about it and then I blew it. So anyway, but, because
work on forgiving yourself
because that theme is so fast.
It is.
And for all of you who are going to write and say, keep that theme and don't go back to the other one. No, we're going to go back to the other one. I'm just telling you now.
As soon as the end of the show today, you will hear the current theme.
Yes,
again.
The current theme. Which
I
has...
love how vocal the listeners are. They're really invested.
We love it too.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember the Hank Gross, Lou Bruno?
Yeah.
Situation of 2002 or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do
yeah.
you remember that?
I've heard about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He changed his name.
Yeah.
But he's still on the air.
Yeah, I mean, that's
same
guy.
Same
just
guy.
Changed
just,
his name
yeah.
back to his regular name. Where did Lou Bruno go?
That was a radio. Yeah. Oh. That was a radio thing where you changed your name. But yeah. we never. You were Susan Price.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not
right.
here. Not here. Here I was always Susan Arbetter. But
yes.
when I did the kind of radio that you used to do at
ENU.
Right. I was at WTRY PIX. I was Susan Price. Yeah.
Oh, the good old days.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
So we want to play one more story of yours. And as we say our goodbyes this morning to you. And this is a cool story you did about this aired on NPR.
This is a story about a woman who was in remission from cancer at the time. Her name was Anita Webb. And she said one of the things that gets her through some of the treatments that she had to go through was doing the trapeze. And I think that's all I need to say to introduce it.
Excellent.
I went to the trapeze place in Connecticut, and that's where this takes place.
The trapeze place.
It's a wonderful story. Yes.
I love you.
I love you back.
Thank you so much for
you.
This and an amazing moment. And listeners are loving it. I'm loving it. I'm glad you're having a good time.
I am.
And we thank you so, so much. And you can watch Susan tonight at
7 p.m. Monday through Friday, Spectrum News.
There you go.
Thank you.
Off to the trapeze.
The trapeze rig at Camp Getaway in Kent, Connecticut looks like a woven version of the Brooklyn Bridge. The structure is surprisingly large. The rig is a complicated macrame of pulleys, ropes, and ladders that rises from the ground with both elegance and menace. On this Saturday, as they do almost every Saturday during the summer and fall, members of Trapeze Experience's advanced class will spend 2 hours swinging and bouncing on the rig like amateur Willendas.
Today I want to do the pullover shoot.
62-year-old Anita Webb is a tall woman with a head full of thick gray hair and beautifully muscled arms. She's only been high-flying for about a year, but she's pretty good. The pullover shoot she refers to is a complicated maneuver that requires the flyer to swing through the air and then launch herself into the hands of a catcher on another swing. It's difficult, and Webb has not been able to complete the trick even once. But today, she hopes to work up to it after warming up on a few simpler moves.
All right, nice and flat. Forward, backward, stand up. Backward, forward, flat. Forward, backward, stand. Backward, forward, flat. Okay, Anita, let's save your hands next time.
As Webb swings back and forth, the trapeze instructor yells out directions. Her first warm-up is done. Webb plunges to the net below. Webb and most of the other members of the self-proclaimed Frequent Flyers Club have been flying together for years.
Everything I do and everything I think about is toward the flying trapeze.
Webb drives 6 hours from Philadelphia to get here each weekend for this two-hour class. The senior citizen says she hopes to fly for the rest of her life.
It's estimated a flyer's life is about 12 to 15 years. So I figure that takes me to 76, and I might as well go to 80.
Each of the high flyers is completely committed to the trapeze, whether for the physical workout, the zen-like quality of flying, or for the camaraderie of the group. When talking about flying, these type A personalities, some surgeons, therapists, or computer experts use words like supportive, addictive, and even magic.
I'll tell you, I came down after my first catch, and I said, that was better than sex.
38-year-old Vivian Steinberg.
Of course, I should say now that sex has, you know, found its place back at the top of the list, but the first catch was really, it was the most incredible thing in my life. That's all I can say.
48-year-old David Katzenstein says trapeze has a supernatural element that flyers find addictive.
They're doing something that's cartoon, that people shouldn't be able to do in regular life, okay? Pharmaceutical salespeople, computer people, orthopedic surgeons, eye surgeons are not supposed to be flying through the air with the greatest of ease, okay? Where could we dream of getting an opportunity to do this?
But writer Sam Keen, author of a book on the trapeze called Learning to Fly, says the lore of the sport goes even deeper than that. He says the trapeze is a way to conquer fear, to look fear in the face and dispense with it.
I say that trapeze has given me a chance to become a connoisseur of my fears. It's completely transformed my body and my sense of what age is. I just don't feel anymore like I'm getting older.
Good. Hands. Okay.
It's finally time for Anita Webb to perform the pullover shoot she's been working on for 2 weeks. Up on the platform, she rolls her neck and shakes out her arms. She's nervous. Her face is taut. If she doesn't make it this time, it'll be another week before she can try again. This is her last flight of the day. As the instructor calls her to jump, Webb swings above the net and scrambles into a sitting position on the bar. She swings again and then launches into the arms of the catcher.
Oh.
She's done it. She releases her grip and drops into the net, making her way into the waiting arms of her friends in the Frequent Flyers Club.
Anita!
How do you feel?
Oh, I feel absolutely wonderful. I've been working on that since 2 weeks ago. Look, I'm getting a hug now from Vivian. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Oh my God. Vivian, I got it.
Yes!
Oh, I'm so happy.
Victory lap! Oh, victory.
For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Arbetter in Kent, Connecticut.
That was so cool to listen to, and such a great piece. Susan did a longer version of that for us here on the roundtable as part of our show, and then that was a piece that was cut down for NPR and worked for our purposes here time-wise. So, a really, really great piece, and just shows how good Susan is in telling those stories. It was so much fun to see her today.
I have never been in studio with Susan Arbetter before.
Oh, my God.
So those couple of minutes overlap really felt like a whole thing.
So much. It was, we did it for a really long time. And you were the one who noted this to me the other day, but I've been doing the show without Susan longer than I did the show with Susan.
Almost twice as long.
And where it, you know, where that ends and where this begins, you know, it gets all very muddy. I don't remember all of that.
Yeah. Well, and also the evolutions of the program and the clock and the schedule weren't, you know, there wasn't a date where it all changed. It was gradual.
Very incremental. I was thinking Susan said this earlier that we were on for 2 hours. I remember the show starting and I think being 90 minutes. And then going very quickly, like within a month, to 2 hours. Yesterday, as we did our broadcast from Oneonta, and we had a second part of the program that was on tape, but the first part was all live. And I thought, 90-minute shows are nice.
Yeah, little feels pretty manageable. 90
yeah,
minutes.
It's a little more manageable.
Like about the run of a good-length comedy film.
Really quick.
It goes really fast, yeah.
Really, really fast. So that's cool.
We're going to air some archival pieces of yours as well.
Yeah, we have a couple things that I was that I had some really incredible opportunities to do. And so we'll take a break and we'll come back and listen to a couple things that we have in the hopper here.
So anyway, then we do this.
The old Gershwin tune goes, "Nice work if you can get it." Today in the plush Condé Nast Tower offices of the New Yorker magazine, there are about 30 men and women trying to get some nice work. They pace back and forth with furrowed brows, indulging in an occasional glance at their portfolios, as if to reassure themselves that they really belong here. Here is the contributors' lounge outside the office of New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. And these men and women are New Yorker cartoonists.
The New Yorker is to magazine cartooning what God is to religion, really. There's no other magazine that matters.
It's no wonder the tension in the room is palpable. The cartoonists are competing with each other. It's first come, first serve, but a cartoonist can wait up to 3 hours for a brief editorial meeting with Mankoff, who sifts through thousands of their cartoons each week. He has the unenviable task of whittling down the number of cartoons accepted to about 20. These will appear in next week's issue of the magazine. The rest will not.
When I look at cartoons, having done this a long time, I'm more than actually reacting to them, I'm processing them. I'm understanding them, and okay, this is funny. I mean, I can look at 30 cartoons, you know, in a minute. And see them and understand them. And you can't actually take time out to enjoy 1,000 cartoons. It's sort of like wine tasting or something like that. So the reason that my whole point here is that it's an impossible job to do, and I'm the only one in the world who can do it.
While Mankoff decides the fate of a colleague in one office, the rest of the hopeful cartoonists pass the time clutching the manila folders and large postal envelopes that hold the cartoons they've been toiling over for the past week. Ask to see them, and they'll either bring you into a corner and protectively show you one or two, or simply tell you no. Of the ones you do see, the humor is typical New Yorker. Two dogs looking at scraps of paper in their food dish. One says to the other, "Oh no, not homework again." A husband and wife sit on a sofa. The wife asks, "What do you think sitting around being bored out of your mind will be like in the new millennium?" It's Mankoff's job to decide which one makes it into the magazine. A tough job, but one he's familiar with. Mankoff became the New Yorker cartoon editor in 1997. Before that, he was one of the nervously pacing artists out in the hall. His work first started to appear in the magazine in the mid-1970s. Now he sits in a small office overlooking the city and surveys the work of hundreds of cartoonists, including Ed Koren, Roz Chast, George Booth, and William Hamilton. For Mankoff, editing is nice work, and he's glad he got it.
It's a lot easier rejecting than being rejected. Don't let anybody tell you different, as they will. It's so hard, my heart goes out. Your heart does go out, but then you go on to the next thing. And of course, you get to ride around in the big limo, which is great.
On the other side of his office's sliding door is the group of seasoned, anxious cartoonists waiting for their name to be called. Mort Gerber, whose cartoons have been appearing in The New Yorker for decades, is one of those angst-filled artists waiting for his few minutes with the editor.
It's has been described as a longshoreman's shape-up. You go down and you can show yourself and you see if you get the work. And that's, I've often also described it as a process of weekly humiliation.
Do you ever get used to the humiliation?
Never. I mean, it's always, it's part of the process. It's, I mean, part of the ground rules. You go in and you get rejected, and that's it. And every once in a while you get an acceptance. I guess the process is mostly getting us all together and sharing all this pain and anguish, you know, because who else is going to understand it? Your dog, your canary, your wife certainly doesn't understand it. She couldn't care less. She's going to take out the garbage, you know.
Gerberg is just outside the lounge area talking with fellow cartoonist Warren Miller, who has had over 1,400 cartoons published by The New Yorker. Miller and Gerberg both look like they're about to be called into the principal's office. Both hope at least one of the cartoons they are clutching will be deemed worthy to be placed in the legendary 75-year-old literary institution known as The New Yorker.
Are there times when you come in with 12, do you ever come in and say, well, this has got to be the one?
Oh, yeah, every week. Every week. You know, you've got one or two that you really think of absolutely the best.
Bringing your children in, you know, right. And it's, you know, your pet dog or something, and it's always astounding when nobody likes it, you know, because you've been working on it, it's your baby. You know.
A short time later, Mankoff opens the sliding door of his office and calls for Gerberg. It is the moment that the cartoonist has been waiting for and dreading for the past week.
See, this is the process. This is this process. And he looks at his hand, he makes the pile, he makes
the
leap.
But I don't laugh, right?
He never laughs, never laughs. Goes through this whole process and you think, well, what is he thinking about?
You know what it is? I save the laughs up for when I'm home. When I'm going on Metro North home, I laugh all the way.
I thought that's the part where the regurgitation, I throw up so nobody can see about it, too.
As Gerberg looks on, Mankoff takes the cartoons and places them into two piles. The larger of the two consists of the cartoons that will not be seen by New Yorker readers.
So you see, this is the scintillating process, you see. See, underneath there's this tension, but you're not supposed to hold on to. Underneath you're all sweating bullets. You think, well, is he going to really hold that great one or not? See, there's no way of nudging him. Like, body English doesn't work. Body English doesn't work.
All right, can I hold these?
See that? See, you need to hold that.
In the end, Gerberg is handed back a pile of 10 cartoons. Mankoff has kept two. Those drawings will be added to the final round of about 40 cartoons that Mankoff will take to New Yorker editor David Remnick, who, with Mankoff, will pare down to about half. As a man who has spent most of his career on the other side of the desk, Mankoff knows what rejection feels like. Even though two of Gerberg's cartoons have been considered, 10 still have been rejected. Mankoff says that makes you into a very superstitious person.
If you sell two cartoons in a row, you wear the same shirt. I remember when you're drawing ideas, because, you know, it's the same thing. You confront a blank piece of paper and you try to think of stuff, and that's always difficult. When the creative act is always difficult, and you're not getting anywhere, and, you know, I remember I would change my shirt sometimes. My wife would say, why are you changing your shirt? And I'd say, there are no ideas in that shirt. So you become very superstitious. And because the random nature of the process, and you imagine things that exist that don't. And also, most people who are involved in creative endeavors and who somehow want recognition, the recognition is never enough. The need for it, which is part of the creative force, is only temporarily assuaged. And then the doubts come back.
Outside Mankoff's door, the remainder of the hopeful cartoonists sit, trying to figure out what will be accepted and what will not. You would think these masters would know, but they are continually surprised. Cartoonist Danny Shanahan does not know the secret, but he knows what the ingredients are for a good cartoon.
It has to be funny. I don't think there's any other real criteria. It has to be obviously somewhat well-drawn in that it can't be completely visually undecipherable. But other than that, I think that it's wide open. And as the years go by, you see that in the pages of the magazine.
The New Yorker cartoons have been a hallmark of the magazine since its beginning. Only a few other magazines, notably Playboy and the Saturday Evening Post, run cartoons. As a result, the New Yorker cartoons are a popular tradition that readers often go to before they read a single article. Say New Yorker, and most people will think of a cartoon. For cartoonists, the magazine stands alone as a golden bottle of India ink. Because of their popularity, it makes you wonder why more magazines do not include cartoons. Mankoff says the success of the New Yorker's cartoons and their timeless feel comes from tradition and style. Which brings up the question, what makes a cartoon a New Yorker cartoon?
The cartoonists aren't making the jokes for you. They're making them for themselves, and they hope you like them. So there's no condescension. We don't view the people who look at the magazine as a demographic, that we're going to try to figure it out, that you're stupider than us, and that I don't think, you know, I think in a lot of comedy writing, a lot of writing in general say, well, I don't like it, but they'll like it. The definition of a New Yorker cartoon is, we like it. We hope you like it. We think you will.
It certainly seems that people do like them. The cartoons are as much a part of the magazine as the cover and the staples. UCLA cultural historian and author of A History of the Magazine, Mary Corey, says the cartoons play a very important role in The New Yorker.
The cartoons are a special element of the magazine. In my book, I describe them as the id of the magazine, the unconscious. They lag behind in terms of sort of political correctness or consciousness the rest of the magazine, which is kind of a great thing about them for a cultural historian.
Corey believes while the cartoons have shifted somewhat from the days when James Thurber, Charles Adams, and Peter Arno's work appeared, the future of the cartoons in the magazine is secure. Editor Bob Mankoff agrees.
Well, there was a whole generation of cartoonists like anyone else who grew up in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and what they were sort of responding to in a lot of ways was the comedy radio shows, the back and forth, the line. A whole generation of cartoonists now, I think, as their model of something like a show like Saturday Night Live, it's some more of a skit. So that's very significant in how comedy changes, and you know, when they ask these questions, how it's going to change in the millennium. I would say that one of the things you will see, it's almost like politics in a way, you will find that the cartoons will be influenced by the humor and the type of humor that the young person saw.
The black and white world of a New Yorker cartoon is admittedly a strange place to find comfort. But to the thousands of readers of this American cultural icon, these regular features provide some down-home reassurance in an ever-changing world. These simple cartoons strike a chord within us by mirroring life's little aggravations, and then distorting them, making us laugh at our own flaws. They play with our stereotypes, tap on our intuition, and in the end, after a moment of self-recognition, there's a chuckle. Always a chuckle. For the cartoonist, it's nice work, if you can get it. For WAMC News, I'm Joe Donahue.
Nice work if you can get it. Nice work if you can get it. And if you get it, won't you tell me how?
Oh, man. I remember when putting that piece together that I was having a crisis as to whether I wanted Tony Bennett to do Nice Work If You Can Get It, or if I wanted Mel Torme.
Okay.
I decided on Mel Torme, and I don't remember why.
Well,
but,
that's okay.
I do, because that is one of my favorite, Fred Astaire album of Tony Bennett's is one of my favorite albums, so I got to use that. I also remember about that piece is that one of my favorite lines that I've ever written for a radio piece is they look to it as a golden bottle of India ink. And I was always proud of that line. That the fact that
paints it, a picture, pun intended.
The fact that that made it through the editing, I was always very proud of that. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's our 25th anniversary, and we're going down memory lane. Susan Arbetter was here. We had a great group this morning of panelists and people that have been with the show since the very beginning, with Sarah LeDuc now. And yeah, I mean, we were just talking. I mean, we said this, but you've been with the show for 17 years.
Just about, yep.
And obviously have done a lot of work behind the scenes, but a lot of work on the air as well.
That's right. And now we're going to air one of the most exciting and lasting impact personally in interviews that I have ever done.
Doesn't get more personal than this.
It
does
didn't
it?
Start that way, but it turned into something pretty special. So can I throw to it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. This year, as the Roundtable marks 25 years, Hamilton, the American musical, is celebrating 10 years of its debut in New York City. And when it was a workshop downstate, I got to talk to Lin-Manuel Miranda, and we're going to hear part of that right now. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. As we here at WAMC celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Roundtable, a little American musical is celebrating 10 years since it premiered in New York City and quickly became a once-in-a-generation success in terms of reviews, ticket sales, fan enthusiasm, and awards recognition. Hamilton opened off-Broadway at the Public Theater on January 20th, 2015, and played there through May 3rd. It opened on Broadway at the Richard Rogers Theater in early August of 2015, where it is still running. Hamilton won 11 Tony Awards, a 2016 Grammy Award for its cast recording, and the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. It has played and is playing all over the world. A pro tape of the production's original cast streams on Disney Plus and was a pandemic sensation. Written by and originally starring Lin-Manuel Miranda, Hamilton's success helped elevate the careers of its cast and creative team. It launched Miranda into the stratosphere of professional artistic opportunity on stage and in Hollywood. But before all that, the Hamilton mixtape was a work in progress, put up in a black box stage reading presented by New York Stage and Film and Vassar College in the summer of 2013. And I did get to be there, in the room where it was starting to happen. Here's a portion of my archival interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda from 2013.
You ever read a book and fall in love? That's what happened to me. I was going on vacation with my then-girlfriend, now wife. And it was my first vacation from Heights. I had a week off in the summer. And I grabbed Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton off the shelf at Borders when bookstores still existed in New York. You know, I just wanted a big, long book to zone out to. I love historical biographies. And I didn't know much about Hamilton other than what I'd learned in history class in high school. And I said, well, at least this will have a cool ending. Because that's mainly what people know about Alexander Hamilton, is how it ended. I just fell in love from the first chapter. I think the things that resonated with me about his story are, one, it's not only an immigrant story, it is the proto-immigrant story. It is, if the myth of the American dream is immigrant comes here to work hard and make good, that's what Hamilton did in spades. He came here on the strength of his writing, got a scholarship because he had written a poem that was so good, people collected money to get him off the island of St. Croix and send him to get an education. He sort of immersed himself in military history to make himself useful in the Revolutionary War until he was recommended to George Washington by three separate sources and became his aide-de-camp. He was fluent in French and in English, became an indispensable, most of Washington's correspondence during the Revolutionary War is in Hamilton's handwriting. He sort of ran the office. And the whole time itching to fight, miserable because he wants to fight, because he knows social mobility only occurs through military service in this yet unformed nation. The first letter we have of Hamilton is him writing to a friend at age 14 saying, I wish there was a war. So this guy knew what he was doing. And sort of just became first Treasury Secretary under Washington, and then caught beef with every other founding father. I mean, really thought he was the smartest guy in the room. He just happened to be in a room with Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison. And these fights that they had over what the American experiment should be and how it should look are the fights we're still having. The stakes being that much higher because we've just escaped British rule. And so everything, I mean, we think stakes are high now, we think we fight, but everyone is accused of plotting to overthrow the government every 5 seconds. And that's what it's like in an emerging democracy. And then, you know, basically, like, his words finally got him into trouble with Aaron Burr, with whom he'd had a professional friendship / competition all his life, and then he got shot in Weehawken, New Jersey. And from the second chapter of Ron Chernow's book, I said this is a hip-hop musical, because it's all about words, and it's about using words to save yourself, to pull yourself out of your circumstances, and also to self-destruct.
How do you decide that it will definitely be a show that you're going to work on, and then you start developing it, and where do you begin?
I was writing it on vacation.
That's not much of a vacation then, Len.
It was for me because it was this in a world I really didn't know a lot about, and I've since immersed myself in sort of this chapter in history. I tell people I feel like a mosquito that hit an artery because there's so much there. I mean, there's so much about the way we live now that was being decided by these guys who were making it up as they went along. And that is interesting to me to capture, and it's interesting to sort of get into also the personal animus that gives rise to these policies we have today. You know, Hamilton having grown up on the island of Nevis, that was sort of the center point of the triangle trade, an island where blacks outnumbered whites 3-1. And he's a firm abolitionist all his life. Like, he's ahead of the curve of the rest of the founding fathers in that respect. One, because he is seen African Americans as people, like way before everyone else. Everyone else has, you know, seen them in through the rubric of this system of slavery. And so, you know, there's that. And there's also, yeah, it's just so rich because it's all the conversations we have now. And but it's like origin stories. It's like the origin stories of the United States.
Is there too much there for one show?
I don't know. I'm trying to get all I can. If I use Hamilton as a through line, that's my way of having the reality check with myself. Because there's tons of detours I want to take, obviously. There's so many interesting chapters. I an example is Benedict Arnold, which I haven't figured out a way to work in. I don't think it's going to make it into the final cut of my show. Benedict Arnold was like a good-ass leader. Like, he was a really good military commander. Burr was working under him as a soldier, and Hamilton was one of the people who found out the plot. They intercepted these letters that Benedict Arnold was sending troop directives to the British. They go to confront him. It's Hamilton, I think it's Lawrence and someone else. I might be getting this wrong. I don't want to get it wrong on public radio. I'll really sound like a jerk. But it's Hamilton, two other guys go to, like, confront Arnold at his house. And Mrs. Arnold is there with an open robe, ranting and raving like a lunatic. They're going to put me away. I'm innocent. And they were also distressed at the sight of this, like, half-naked woman sort of babbling to herself. And they all fell for it. They all said, oh, this poor woman, she is innocent in her husband's schemes. They sent her back to London. History has since told us she was complicit. She knew what he was doing. She just put on, like, a naked lady raving act to get out of trouble. I mean,
who hasn't done that once or twice?
How do you not put that in your musical? And yet I can't, because it's just an interesting detour in this incredible story of sort of the Revolutionary War and what we found it after.
You could do the founding of America Revolutionary Saga series, do a play cycle.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many interesting detours. There's so many interesting characters. You know, some of Hamilton's friends include John Lawrence, who was really his closest friend, and spent a good amount of the Revolutionary War in the South trying to raise the first all-black militia and getting voted down at every turn. And, Lafayette, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was a French noble who came here and who just heard about what was going on in America, was like, I gotta go, left a pregnant wife in France to go fight. You know, these are interesting, rich characters. And so it's, you know, it's a feast in terms of detail, what you can draw upon.
I knew this was going to be a really fun interview, and it's surpassed my expectations. Oh, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I know you're about to get crazy, so thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was part of my 2013 interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda as part of our 25th anniversary celebration of The Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
Well, you talk about understatement of the year. things are about to get crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it was the explosion that was larger audiences being able to see that show. It was, you know, unmatched, unrivaled in history, practically. It was, like I said in the introduction, a once-in-a-generation hit musical that you couldn't get tickets to for ages, or they were incredibly expensive, but also just the way it was embraced by the Obama White House, and then it's been playing in London for years now, too. It's, yeah, big success.
So we have a moment or two. Explain how this led to your engagement.
So because I was already a fan of Lin's work, because he had had a huge success on Broadway within the Heights, I was very excited about this interview. I don't know if you recall, but when they said when New York Stage and Film at Vassar said he might be available for an interview, I turned around to you and I was like, God, please.
Yeah.
And you were like, yes. Yeah, I think you're going to drop dead if I don't say yes. So, of course, go ahead. Then, because I did get to see that staged reading at Vassar, I was just lucky to be early, fortunate to have seen it, and became entirely obsessed. Couldn't believe the mastery of the lyrics, loved the songs, loved the performances in that workshop. And so then very closely followed it, saw it when it opened off Broadway. It was mine and my now husband Paul's first Valentine's Day. And we met Lin in the lobby afterward. And Paul told him that I had loved Hamilton longer than I had loved Paul, and Lin apologized. And it was true at that time that I had loved the show, like been more obsessed with the show than Paul, because we'd been dating for less time than I'd been obsessed with Hamilton. Paul, a natural introvert and not a mover and a shaker in this way by any stretch, embraced the passion, saw the show and adored it too, like, you know, bawling throughout and just loved it. And finagled to contact Lin-Manuel Miranda's father. And this is not something you can do anymore because, as we said, the show exploded. It was like a shot in the, what do you call that? Like a moonshot that was accomplishable one time, to set up for Paul to propose to me on the stage of the Richard Rogers Theater with Lin-Manuel Miranda and his father there. And he asked me to marry him, and I said yes.
And you're still married.
And we're still married. We're very happily married. And I thank him frequently still for doing that, because I grew up in Saranac Lake, just loving Broadway, never expecting to be anywhere proximate to it in any manner, and am like a, you know, sort of romantic, enthusiastic, attention-liking personality. So to have a big proposal is something I didn't think, like, would happen. I didn't think I was going to get married until I started dating Paul, and then it's just pretty magical. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been able to do that interview and get early access to the show.
You know, one of the things that you just said, this, which it just struck me, but you said moonshot, but at that time, I mean, that show was still like, it was the talk of the town.
Oh yeah, it was buzzing.
I mean,
it wasn't
like nobody was talking about it before it was going.
Right. Lin had performed one of the songs, the first song, for the Obama White House at an evening of music and poetry, I think in 2009. It took like 5 years to write Act One, a couple years to write Act Two. It was going to be a success, but that workshop at Vassar was one of those sort of guarantee, like you get a, you know, it's definitely a step in the process that heads it toward its ultimate success. And it's, you know, I still love it. It's a good show.
Yeah, it's it's and stood the test of time and is as relevant as ever. We're going to take a break. When we come back, you're going to hear a story that I did. It's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. I get to go to Sesame Street.
So exciting.
It was really, really cool for their 30th anniversary. Now we're 25. We'll be right back.
Here we go. From the top.
From the stuffy.
5, 3, 4, 3, 2.
Hi. Hi. Hi.
On stage G of the Kaufman Astoria Studios in Queens, New York, a collection of actors and puppets are at the foot of the steps of 123 Sesame Street, a large brownstone that serves as the centerpiece of this neighborhood.
Hey. Oh, hi! Welcome to Sesame Street. I'm glad you're here, because I want you to meet the signing singers.
The neighborhood is a mix of humans and furry creatures called Muppets. The cast and crew assembled on the 12,060 feet of studio space are currently filming show number 3,823, which will air in mid-February. This particular show has the Sesame Street gang deciding to surprise Linda, who is deaf, on her birthday by singing and signing Happy Birthday. The episode is brought to us by the number 6 and the letter H.
A talking letter H?
Oh, we have lots of talking letters on Sesame Street.
Well, when I bought this store, they told me it was in an interesting neighborhood.
Interesting indeed. It is common to develop a furrow in the brow when you first see an 8'2" yellow bird or a disgruntled green monster living in a trash can. However, unlike Alan, the new owner of Hooper's store on Sesame Street, most people are already quite familiar with Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch and the other oddities of the street, as well they should be. Sesame Street has been on the air entertaining and educating for 30 years. The U.S. Department of Education recently determined that 77% of all preschool children watch Sesame Street at least once a week. It is also estimated that the show has reached more than 120 million children in more than 130 countries. A production of Children's Television Workshop, Sesame Street has grown from a televised educational experiment into a landmark television program, as well as a lucrative business. It's hard to walk into any preschooler's bedroom and not find a Sesame Street character in one form or another. Since Sesame Street took to the airwaves on November 10, 1969, a plethora of programs for children made their debut. Most failed. But Sesame Street keeps rolling along. Bob McGrath plays Bob on the show and believes there are key reasons why the show has survived.
I think a great deal of credit goes to Joan Ganz Cooney, whose dream this was well over 30 years ago. They spent a year and a half or 2 years worth researching the show, determining what the needs were for preschool kids. This was about the time in the late 60s when Head Start funds were being cut, which was why they got the $6.5-7 million up front to put this show together. And so I think the focus has always been to try and reach and teach kids that particularly need this help, kids from inner cities and from the projects and so forth. And I think that focus has stayed pretty clearly, although, of course, millions of kids that don't come from those backgrounds benefited just as well.
Each hour of Sesame Street is made up of animated clips, mini-films, and segments featuring the Muppets. That material was woven into a storyline featuring the cast of the street itself. Arlene Sherman, supervising producer of the show, says Sesame Street is designed with one thing in mind.
We're trying to prepare children for school. So I think if you looked at the overall portion of the show, if you looked at the show holistically, and you said, what is each show trying to do? We are trying to teach very cognitive skills, letters and numbers, things like that, that children can grasp onto, and when they get to school, their teachers may be impressed that they have mastered these skills. But overall, if there's one thing I think we're trying to do, I think it's we're... if a child can walk away from the Sesame Street experience feeling a little bit better about who he or she is, then we've done our job.
Spend a little time around the set of Sesame Street, and you hear the word curriculum a lot. Much like school, each day the show has an overall plan in mind. Michael Lohman is the show's executive producer.
The model for Sesame Street is a unique model. It begins with a curriculum before anything is created in terms of a script or a song or an animation. And then those creative processes go on teaching that particular segment of the curriculum that we want taught, so that for every minute of the 60 minutes, we are teaching something. And so it's not a show which throws in some education or tries to satisfy an FCC requirement. We really, the structure of the show is education.
Curriculum is so important to the show that Sesame Street's research department has created a curriculum book. That book, filled with issues and ideas, is then passed on to the writers. Lou Berger, the show's head writer, says his department works extremely closely with the researchers, but they are not told what to write.
What's wonderful is it's this sort of flowing back and forth that the writers are not told, go off and write this. This is what you must write. The writers are aware of the curriculum. they're given certain assignments and curriculum is suggested to them that, gosh, we do need the letter D. We do need the number 13. They're each given a letter and a number of the day, but then they have a huge smorgasbord of curriculum to choose from. If we ignore curriculum, we're reminded, gee, could somebody write for conflict resolution? Could somebody write for geometric shapes?
Berger says the writers began writing, much like a playwright does, by writing something that they want to write about, and something that is fun to write. But he says it's hard to write anything without teaching children something.
It's very hard to come up with any wonderful idea that doesn't begin to involve some curriculum. Be it that Telly decides that he's just gotten a new copy of the Triangle Lovers newspaper, the Triangle Times. Well, already we're teaching reading, we're teaching geometric shaped triangle, and then maybe in that triangle paper there's a competition. Who could come up with it? And we've done this. One of our writers did this. Who could come up with a tongue twister, the best tongue twister about triangles? Suddenly, he has to practice. They have to write. They have to create. But it all grows out of, gee, it would really be fun, because we know that Telly is obsessed with triangles, to come up with a show. And then we begin to hit the different curriculum. Wow, this is all. It involves practice. Oh, somebody, he needs help. So Rosita decides, I'll be your coach. Suddenly, we have cooperation. Every single scene that you see on the show actually has a curriculum goal written on the script.
All of this is done while the writers are also attempting to entertain the parents watching. The show has always included comedy gems that may go over the heads of the kids, but get a chuckle out of mom and dad. Berger says he noticed that about the program when he used to watch the show with his son, even before he started working on Sesame Street.
I remember watching with him, and it was a scene, it was one of those Kermit the Frog fairy tales, and Kermit was looking for a princess in distress. And he came running onto the set, and I remember he came running and said, he went over to a princess, one of the Muppets, and said to her, are you a princess in distress? And she said, what does this look like, a pantsuit? And I remember thinking, that is so great, that's so silly. That now I know that he didn't get it, at that time he was about two, he didn't get the joke, he didn't get the pun, at the same time he was loving the story, and that at that moment it works on both levels. The fun of writing for Sesame Street is that basically we are writing a show that we would like to watch.
Oh, no, not you again.
Oh, yes, it is me again, sir, your same friendly waiter. But today, Charlie's is different.
Well, I hope the service is better.
Oh, not only will the service be better, it will be cheerfully changed.
Cheerfully changed?
Exactly, because today everything in Charlie's restaurant begins with the ch sound, just like in the name Charlie. This is Charlie's birthday. Aren't you thrilled?
Charming.
The humor for grown-ups is added to encourage parents to watch with their children. And while producers hope parents will watch with their kids, the show is designed so the children can watch it unsupervised. Only once in the show's history was it strongly recommended that Sesame Street be viewed as a family activity. About 16 years ago, Sesame Street aired a special program in a later time slot when Mom and Dad would be home. That program dealt with the subject matter the show's producers wanted to make sure the entire family could discuss. In 1983, Will Lee, who portrayed Mr. Hooper, died. The decision was made by the writers and producers not to replace the actor or have him move away. Instead, scriptwriters carefully crafted a show that told young children about death.
Big Bird, don't you remember we told you? Mr. Hooper died. He's dead.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
Well,
I'll give it to him when he comes back.
Big Bird, Mr. Hooper's not coming back.
Why not?
Big Bird, when people die, they don't come back.
Ever?
No, never.
Why not?
Well, Big Bird, they're dead. They can't come back.
You know, I'm gonna miss you, Mr. Looper.
That's Hooper, Big Bird. Hooper.
With all of the show's accomplishments, over 100 major awards, including 71 Emmys, more than any other show in history, this anniversary season has not been all celebration. The show is being criticized for ending a 30-year streak of commercial-free broadcasts. The show, in addition to being funded by the government and viewers like you, is now being partially supported by indoor playground manufacturer Discovery Zone. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader, who has been a guest on the show, has urged parents to protest the Discovery Zone sponsorship, accusing Sesame Street of exploiting impressionable children. Sesame Street producers say the message does not interrupt the show, and the funding is necessary to ensure the program's continued production. Meanwhile, executive producer Michael Lohman says with funding and mission intact, the show will continue to thrive.
I think the future of the program is as it has been in the past for the last 30 years, that we are always making changes. Every year we look at the show and we say, what can we do better? How can we better meet the needs of children of today? It began as an experiment, and we think of it as an experiment, and we think that it's incumbent upon us to always look at how to improve it to meet the needs of children. So I see vastly more changes going on through the years, as have gone on in the past 30 years, in this never-ending quest to be better.
With the bright studio light shining down on the cast and crew, it does always seem like a sunny day on the set of Sesame Street, but that mood is not just a result of the lighting. The visitor to the set feels like they're attending a family gathering. After all, the cast and crew have been working together so long, in many cases the full 30 years, they're all comfortable with their surroundings and their mission. It's hard to find someone in a bad mood on Sesame Street, but that doesn't mean the clouds are always kept at bay. Producers of the show say funding remains an issue, and with criticism from Ralph Nader and other groups, that funding may not always be easy to come by. Until then, though, this benchmark of children's educational television will continue to do what it does best, make children and adults smile. Reporting from Sesame Street, I'm Joe Donahue.